The future is on the line. Democracy hangs in the balance. The stakes couldn't be higher.
It's Thursday, May 14th, 2026. You're listening to The Stakes, KPFA's new show about the upcoming midterm elections. I'm Teresa Wersbianska with Scott Baba. On today's show, we'll take a deep dive into the current candidate field for California governor with LA Times political writer Mark Baraback. We'll also talk voter suppression with Jenny Farrell from the League of Women Voters. All that and a lot more on The Stakes after these news headlines. In just 20 days, California voters and some voters around the country will head to the polls to vote in the primary midterm elections. You're listening to The Stakes. I'm Teresa Wersbianska.
And I'm Scott Baba. On today's show, we're going to speak with LA Times political writer Mark Baraback about the California governor's candidate field as that race begins to take shape following the abrupt exit of former frontrunner, disgraced Congressman Eric Swalwell.
We'll also look at what we can do to combat voter suppression with the League of Women Voters. But first, here's what's happening around the country as we head into Election Day on June 2nd. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries spoke on Capitol Hill yesterday and warned Republicans they would come to regret the congressional redistricting fight they started when the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. Virginia officials are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to allow the state to move forward with a voter-approved redistricting plan that could give Democrats up to 4 additional seats in Congress. Virginia High Court rulings wiped out the Democratic gains in Virginia and threatened to erode black representation by Democrats in the Deep South. Here's Representative Hakeem Jeffries speaking on Capitol Hill yesterday.
Because at the end of the day, here's what we do know. Republicans have concluded that they need to cheat to win. That's what they're celebrating? Is that what you're elevating right now? The notion that 4 unelected judges would overturn the votes of more than 3 million citizens in Virginia? Is this what Republicans are celebrating right now? Because the people in Virginia right now are outraged, they're angry, and they're determined to send a message in November, regardless of what ultimately happens before the Supreme Court of the United States of America, where that reckless decision by the Virginia Supreme Court is now on appeal.
The shifting political landscape has been a challenge for Democrats, who so far are favored to win back the House this November. But this is also a test for Jeffries, who is in line to become House Speaker if the Democrats regain power.
Over the last week, redistricting battles have rattled southern states after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. Tennessee House Democrats say they are being punished and silenced after House Speaker Cameron Sexton removed members of the caucus from standing committees following protests during a special session on congressional redistricting. Democrats had linked arms on the House floor to protest the new map that divides Memphis and could weaken representation in the state's only Democratic-led congressional district. Tennessee representative from Memphis, Justin Pearson, told supporters yesterday on his social media that this redistricting plan is intended to silence black voters.
And today, we received this letter from Cameron Sexton, who is also known as Ku Klux Cameron because of his persistence in perpetuating white supremacy in our state's capital by decisions like gutting the only majority black district in the state of Tennessee at the behest of Donald Trump and Governor Bill Lee. And now he's kicked every Democrat and every black Democrat off of their committee. This is anti-democratic. This is authoritarianism. This is what the abuse of power looks like in the South. And everybody needs to pay attention. This is not a game. This is silencing our voices where bills are being made that are going to impact the life of each and every one of the 7 million Tennesseans across this state. And he is upset that we stood up against his white supremacist actions of gutting the only majority black district of Memphis. Because we stood up in front of the well, because we spoke up, because we made sure our constituents' voices were heard, we all got kicked out of our committees where we represent the voices of our constituents. This is not normal. This is not okay. This is the deleterious effect of white supremacy in action and the destruction of the very pillars of democracy that so many people say that they believe in. This is a constitutional democratic republic, and this is how we lose it.
Lawmakers called the move unprecedented and retaliatory, arguing it effectively strips representation from about 1.5 million Tennesseans. Some analysts said the action may be legally permissible, but raises serious concerns about democratic processes and whether voters who elected Democrats will still have a voice in legislative decisions.
A small group of Republican state senators in South Carolina this week defied Trump and stalled a push in the GOP-controlled legislature to redraw the state's congressional map, a plan aimed at eliminating the state's only Democratic-held U.S. House seat ahead of the midterm elections.
President Donald Trump said Republicans plan to deploy a much larger election integrity army in all 50 states ahead of the 2026 midterm elections. In a post on his social media platform, True Social, Trump said the effort will expand on the Republican National Committee's 2024 volunteer program, which recruited thousands of poll watchers and legal volunteers to monitor voting and challenge potential irregularities. Trump credited that operation with helping secure his 2024 victory, which he won every major battleground state, as well as both the Electoral College and the popular vote. The announcement echoes Trump's longstanding claims that U.S. elections are vulnerable to fraud, despite repeated court rulings and investigations that have found no evidence of widespread voter fraud. Republicans say the initiative is intended to protect what Trump called the, quote, sanctity of each legal vote during next year's elections.
And as voters are already completing mail-in ballots for the June 2nd primary here in California, many voters are saying they feel like democracy itself is on the ballot. We spoke with KPFA News Director Lauren Schmidt about why KPFA is keeping close tabs on this year's midterms.
Some voters have described the 2026 midterm elections as the most high-stakes election in memory. Joining us to discuss what's at stake this year is KPFA News Director Lauren Schmidt. Hey, Lauren, how are you?
Hi, Scott. Hi, Teresa. Thanks for having me on.
So this is our new show. It's called The Stakes. It's a special spotlight on the 2026 midterm elections. Lauren, what motivated KPFA to launch a new election show?
Thanks, Teresa. Yeah, in a programming meeting a few months back, following the retirement of Mitch Jezerich and Letters in Politics, we were discussing what kinds of shows would be most relevant and useful to our listeners. Here at KPFA, of course, we really see all of our programming as public service, programming that informs and inspires and is rooted in our mission. And as we were discussing the gaps in our current lineup, I think we unanimously agreed that we needed a show focused on elections, not just here in California, but across the country. The primary elections, and especially the general election in November, are shaping up to be some of the most consequential races of our lifetime. And I don't say that lightly or without research. You know, I actually interviewed a source a few months back, the oldest living World War II veteran in Northern California. And by some miracle, he has all of his faculties. And when speaking with him, he told me that he hopes to live at least one more year because he believes this is the most important election of his life of over 100 years. He said that the choices made at the ballot box today will impact the next generations of his family to come. And so we are proud to have this new show, The Stakes, as a joint force between the KPFA newsroom and our programming department, having you, Teresa, and Scott bringing this critical coverage to our airwaves.
So why do you believe the this year's midterms are so important for our listeners and for the future of American democracy?
It's not just conjecture to say America has experienced a backsliding of civil liberties and democracy itself. I mean, if you look globally at press freedom, Reporters Without Borders announced this week that for the first time in a quarter century, the overall average score of countries assessed has never been so low. And here in the United States, we now rank 64 out of 180 countries. Let that sink in. The so-called land of the free and home of the brave now ranks 64th in the world for press freedom. According to Reporters Without Borders, that decline is directly tied to political and electoral pressures. Thomas Jefferson once said, and I quote, "Our liberty depends on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost," close quote. And in 2026, we are watching those limits be tested by billionaires, by foreign governments, by political operatives trying to shape and control public narratives, which is exactly why KPFA, this incredible community radio station, is hoping to be the beacon through the noise.
I also heard that statistic, too, that U.S. has now dropped to number 64 in measurable press freedoms, which is a shocking number when our very first freedom, the First Amendment of the Constitution, is press freedom. A lot of people are really stressed about what are some of the outcomes and what are some of the high stakes of this election. I mean, let's look at Congress. Let's look at control of the House and the Senate. If Democrats just regain one or both chambers, they could block some major parts of Trump's agenda. They could launch some investigations. They could try to stop some of the executive power grabs. If Republicans keep control, this could really have some far-reaching consequences.
Yeah, it's scary.
I could say this, Teresa, To your point of people who are feeling the anxiety and the pressure of these elections, we see you, we hear you, and that's exactly why we want to create this show, to help navigate and traverse this election cycle. But the message I really want to give is to listeners who are feeling fed up with the political process. I would also say that is exactly why this show is so important. Voting is a civic duty, and voters are asked to make informed decisions. But the pathways to reliable information are increasingly limited. And that's exactly why we're launching this show, to break down these critical races, explain what's at stake, and give listeners clear, fact-based information. And even so, I hear people say all the time, why vote? It doesn't matter. It's all rigged anyway. Folks are entitled to their opinions and frustrations, absolutely. But I would remind our listeners that people fought and people died for the right to vote. Would you tell a civil rights activist who was brutalized during the Selma to Montgomery marches that voting doesn't matter? The people who were beaten and trampled by horses, that voting doesn't matter? And I'll remind our listeners that those sacrifices are exactly why we have the Voting Rights Act. And because voting matters so much, we are also seeing major political battles today over that very act, over voting access and representation. And for our millennial and Gen Z audience, if voting didn't matter, why are there so many sophisticated social media campaigns designed to influence whether or not young people participate? We have data and whistleblower testimony showing how political consulting firms create campaigns disguised as grassroots movement that encourage young people, especially young BIPOC voters, not to vote. That strategy was to increase apathy and frame refusing to participate in elections as a form of resistance. The examples go on, and in this first show, we'll be talking about the governor's race, where we're already seeing candidates pour more than $100 million into a single campaign. If voting didn't matter, why would anyone spend that kind of money trying to influence voters? So from the presidency all the way down to your local city council, voting has consequences, and this show is launching because we're here to outline the stakes.
That was really a mic drop moment, Lauren. I feel like even in a regular election year, elections can be overwhelming. There's so many candidates. We don't even know what some of these positions are. We don't even know what they're for. Some of the ballot measures, they can be really tricky. And I think having a space to be able to break them down, discuss them, kind of look at the candidates, look at the ballot measures, look at the issues line by line and race by race is something that I'm personally looking forward to doing. But this election is also different. It's different because it's not just about, well, what's on the ballot. What kind of choice will I make? It's also about how do we hold on to democracy? How do we hold on to democracy when we see very intense voter suppression efforts right now? Those are some of the things I think we're also going to be looking at.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it almost feels like democracy itself is on the ballot. You know, do we even want to have a democratic system, or are we comfortable with a system in which our elected leaders pick their own constituents? These are questions that we kind of have to ask ourselves. What do Americans even want out of their government now?
Another quote that's famously been tossed around is democracy is not a spectator sport, and this is an excellent opportunity to engage and participate.
All right. We've been speaking with KPFA News Director Lauren Schmidt. Thanks for coming on, Lauren.
Thank you both.
The California governor's race is picking up steam in a big way, and I spoke with Los Angeles Times political writer Mark Barabek about who is on the ballot. What do we need to know about our voting options this year? Let's roll that interview. Joining us now is Mark Barabek, a veteran political journalist and columnist for the Los Angeles Times, who has covered California politics, presidential campaigns, and national elections for decades.
Thanks for having me.
So we are here to talk about this California gubernatorial race. It's been a bit of a roller coaster, but you just recently wrote that it seems like the race is finally taking a coherent shape. Where are we at now? We've seen three debates so far. Jump in where you can.
Well, I'll go all the way back to the beginning, which I don't mean the beginning of time, but I mean the beginning of when this race sort of began unfolding. There was a lot of speculation that Vice President Kamala Harris, former state attorney general, former U.S. senator from California, was going to enter the race. And, you know, there are no certainties in life beyond, as they say, death and taxes. But I think it's pretty fair to assume that had Kamala Harris entered the race, she very likely would have been the next governor of California. I mean, there's a lot of talk about this race being so boring, and I've written, and it's my feeling, boring would have been Kamala Harris running, and then months of speculation about who's going to maybe make a runoff against her to then lose in November 2026. Kamala Harris doesn't get in the race, so we go through a very, very long period, up until just maybe a month or so ago, where the race was a big muddle. There was speculation about whether Alex Padilla, the state's senior U.S. senator, was getting the race. He didn't. Eric Swalwell got in the race, seeing a wide open field. San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan got in the race for the same reason, seeing opportunity there. So we bump along for quite a while. And to the detriment, and I would say through no fault of their own, these candidates really, really had a hard time getting folks to pay attention. But Donald Trump is this incredible force that has completely overshadowed just about everything. I think, you know, these guys and gals running for governor could have stood on the Hollywood freeway and lit their hair on fire, and people would have said, gee, did you see what Donald Trump just said or did? Very, very hard for any of them to break out, get any sort of attention. And then just about a month ago, Eric Swalwell's campaign imploded amid allegations of sexual assault, other alleged improprieties. That woke Californians up to the fact that there is a governor's race going on. It's gotten a lot of attention. There was an assumption at that time that Swalwell's support would go to either Katie Porter or Tom Steyer, the two leading Democrats. That didn't happen. And this is where the race begins to cohere. Surprisingly, unexpectedly, much of the Swalwell support went to Javier Becerra. I want to be clear, he's getting 20% or so in the poll, so it's not like he's running away with it yet. But finally, the race seems to be cohering. It seems to be Javier Becerra among Democrats, others vying. And then I should mention the two Republicans in the race. There is Chad Bianco, the Republican sheriff of Riverside County, Steve Hilton, conservative commentator. Hilton has been blessed with the endorsement of Donald Trump. So those two fighting for one of two slots, and we can get to the top two primary, talk about that.
Yeah, and I want to circle back to Becerra and him kind of rising to the top. He was somewhere around like 4% in the polls when Swalwell was still in the race. What do you think is resonating with voters about Becerra?
I think there's a couple things that are going on here. One is sort of your Heisenberg principle. By that, I mean, there's been so much talk and Democratic freaking out about the prospect of being shut out. And I can come back in a minute to the Democratic, the top two primary in June and talk about it. But so much freak out among Democrats being shut out. And I think there's a real sense that, okay, if someone's emerging that we can live with, we're just going to go with that guy, in this case, Javier Becerra, to forestall the possibility of a Democratic shutout. The other thing Javier Becerra has going for him, and I'm going to say, I've written this a few times in columns, you know, there is this stereotype, this image of California, because, you know, we elected Ronald Reagan governor, we elected Arnold Schwarzenegger as governor, the Californians go for glitz and for glamour. Those are two governors in the history of California, spaced apart by 40 years, both elected under rather extraordinary circumstances. Californians tend to elect sort of dull, drab career politicians, and I don't mean that as pejorative, but people like Pete Wilson, George Duke Majan, Gray Davis. I think what the pundits and people sort of looking down their noses at this race in California fail to understand is voters aren't looking to be jollied or entertained. They want a governor who's going to focus on them and their lives and fixing problems. So if you're looking for safe in the sense of not too out there, safe in the sense of forestalling that possibility of Democrats being shut out in June, then to some folks, maybe a lot of them or enough of them to get him to the runoff in November, Javier Becerra could be the safe harbor.
And what do we know about Tom Steyer? Tom Steyer is a billionaire. He's been endorsed by some progressives like Jane Fonda.
Well, I will give you my first, the sort of objective overview, if you will. Tom Steyer, hedge fund billionaire, had his road to Damascus moment, said he's now opposed to things like fossil fuels. He spent a lot of time, a lot of money on issues like green energy and fighting climate change. He's been a very, very big Democratic benefactor over the years. Personally, and this is where I stop being quite so objective, I really personally am put off by all the money he spent. My feeling is that if his name was Tom Steinway and he was just another schmo without all his billions of dollars, he would not be taken seriously as a candidate. But he's got a lot of money. He's spending a ton of it on advertising. His ads are ubiquitous. It's almost impossible to escape from him. So that has vaulted him into contention. As you point out, he has won a number of endorsements, including from some environmental groups. His opponents are criticizing him and have attacked him quite heavily for the billions he, I don't know if it's billions, for the considerable sum of money he made as a venture capitalist dealing with fossil fuels. Again, he says that's all in the past. It's sort of a takes a thief to catch a thief, if you will, strategy. His notion being, look, I'm a billionaire. I can't be bought. I will stand up to the billionaires and the special interests in a way that other candidates can't and won't. That's him talking, not me.
And can we talk about Katie Porter and Katie Porter's performance at this most recent debate? As everybody knows, she got into a bunch of hot water for a video that was released that questioned her comportment. But she's challenging voters, and she's like, that's in the past. I've apologized. She's the only woman in the race. Does that point to kind of double standards on behavior between male and female candidates?
The short answer is yes. I think that there is that double standard. I also think there's gravity, and if you throw something up in the air, it will fall to earth. You may not like it. That's the way it is. I think that there is that double standard. May not like it. That's the way it is. You're right. Katie Porter started out, you know, there was a thought when Kamala Harris was maybe still in the mix, and we're talking about early in the race, that Katie Porter would have been and maybe was the front runner, at least starting out. Won a very close contest, a very hard-fought contest in 2018 in Orange County. Big, big breakthrough there, being elected as a Democrat. Went to Congress, really made a splash with her whiteboard, with her very, very aggressive questioning of CEOs and other corporatites. Really made a name for herself. So Katie Porter in 2018 wins a big, big congressional race in Orange County. Big breakthrough there. Goes to Congress right away, establishes herself as a kind of Democratic superstar on the left. She has her whiteboard, very, very aggressively questioning CEOs, corporate types, made a big name for herself, made a big, big splash, ran for Senate, lost to Adam Schiff. Entered this race pretty well situated, looked like big, wide, nationwide fundraising base. And then, as you suggest, she has a very, very testy interview with a correspondent in Sacramento, which is followed, I don't think accidentally, by a leak of a video of her cursing one of her aides, all of which plays to, fair or not, questions about her comportment, her temperament. And she's, a lot of people wrote her campaign off and said that that was it. Those moments killed her campaign, didn't kill her campaign, but definitely stalled her momentum. And, you know, we'll see. Again, I don't make any predictions, but it seems to have put a ceiling on her. She's still in the fight, but she's really, really fought this whole time to overcome those videos and rise above where she's been, which is, if we reduce sort of tiers, I would say the top tiers are Becerra, Steyer, and then you get to Katie Porter.
And what about Matt Mahan? He's the San Jose mayor. A lot of people have questions about him. He's connected to Silicon Valley. He's considered a centrist. He's criticized Gavin Newsom over homeless policy and other policies.
Well, as you said, first-term mayor of San Jose, I actually did a column. I was favorably impressed with him. I, for one, haven't been particularly tickled by Gavin Newsom's, how would we put it, very, very, very assertive, to my mind, kind of juvenile and foolish online persona. And Matt Mahan called him out, which I thought was deserved. Like I said, he's been more moderate, been running as kind of a moderate, which is a trick in a Democratic primary. But he has been more moderate. He entered the race rather late. Surprisingly, when I talked to him, he was, you know, just ruled out any kind of run for governor. Got in with very, very strong backing from folks in Silicon Valley, and that's been used to criticize him. His opponents, in fact, Tom Steyer has turned it around, the billionaire in the race, has turned it around by saying, well, I'm not the only billionaire or one benefiting from billionaires in the race. A lot of Matt Mahan's support, as I said, has been from the tech community. And I would venture to say that the tech bros these days are, you know, just about as popular as oil companies or the tobacco companies used to be. So that has, I mean, it's given Matt Mahan some lift in the sense of he's not very well known outside the Bay Area. I would venture to say he's not even very well known out of San Jose. He's gotten the money and the support he needs to advertise statewide and try to raise that name recognition. But, you know, what comes attached to that money is the association, as I said, with high tech, with Silicon Valley, which isn't in the best odor with a lot of voters these days.
California holds open primaries, which means that we see Democrats and Republicans competing together in the primary. The top two candidates of any party will rise to the general election, which could mean that we see two Republicans competing in the general election, which is like the nightmare scenario for Democrats. What do you think the chances are of something like that happening?
Very small. I'll back up to explain. As you suggest, all the candidates, Democrat, Republican, Independent, Libertarian, Vegetarian, everyone's on one ballot. If you get your ballot, I've gotten mine, you can open up and be like, holy smokes, there's 61 names there. I've heard from a lot of folks in the sense that basically I'm going to wait till the field clarifies and get closer to election day, and whichever Democrat looks like they are the one, I'm going to vote for them to avoid exactly that scenario, a Democratic shutout.
And make sure you get out there and vote, everyone. Thanks for joining the show, Mark Baraback. Mark Baraback is a veteran political journalist and columnist for the Los Angeles Times and has covered California politics, campaigns, and national elections for decades. Thanks for joining the show, Mark.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the inaugural episode of The Stakes, KPFA's new show, bringing the latest news and analysis for this year's midterm election. GOP lawmakers across the country continue to push their efforts to enact so-called voter security laws, which opponents argue are thinly veiled voter suppression tactics. Last month, the GOP narrowly failed to attach core elements of the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility or Save America Act to a budget reconciliation package that could pass soon with a simple majority vote. While currently stalled in the Senate, many GOP lawmakers are still pushing for the Save Act, which would require voters across the country to show proof of citizenship to be able to vote. It's already illegal for non-citizens to vote, and meanwhile, a report put out by the University of Maryland found that millions of Americans, roughly 1 in 10, don't have easy access to up-to-date documentary proof of citizenship, like a birth certificate, naturalization certificate, or passport. Many GOP-led states have started moving on their own versions of the bill, with Republican lawmakers in Arkansas, Kansas, South Dakota, and West Virginia adding various citizenship-related amendments on the ballot. I spoke with Jenny Farrell, executive director for the League of Women Voters of California, to talk about how such tactics could impact California, as well as what state voters can do to prepare ahead of the upcoming elections. Jenny Farrell is the executive director for the League of Women Voters of California. I guess I'll just jump right in. It feels like in California we're pretty insulated from a lot of the election suppression tactics we're seeing nationally. But at the same time, things are happening at the federal level, like the rule changes at the post office that could potentially let postal workers slow the arrival of ballots until after they can be legally counted. And President Trump's threat just this week to post federal agents at polling places across the country. So how concerned should California voters be about election interference?
Well, unfortunately, we're not totally insulated here in California. We, what happened in Riverside County with Sheriff Chad Bianco illegally seizing over 650,000 ballots is deeply alarming because it represents something we've almost never seen in modern American democracy, which is a law enforcement official using criminal investigatory powers to seize hundreds of thousands of ballots based on unsubstantiated allegations of voter fraud. So, you know, that has happened in California. We also have, there's a new ballot initiative that's recently qualified for the November ballot that would impose new significant voter ID requirements on voters, and we are also concerned about that. We at the League of Women Voters of California want to see things that make it easier for voters to participate in our democracy, not harder. So we are leading the campaign against that initiative as well. And you're right to, you know, mention things that are happening on the federal level, because unfortunately, you know, all of these incidents and policies are kind of part of this troubling pattern of efforts that make voting more difficult, spread misinformation about elections, and undermine public confidence in democracy.
Is there anything happening on the state level in terms of the legislature to try and head off these threats that you're seeing?
Yes, we are actually part of the California Democracy Partnership that is right now advancing the California Voting Rights Act of 2026. It's a package of two bills, SB 1360 and SB 1164. Unfortunately, the federal government is mounting these, repeated attacks on fair and accessible elections. And, voters of color really face the biggest assault on their voting rights since the Jim Crow era. So these bills would enshrine powerful and critical voting rights protections into state law and strengthen California's democracy by giving these voters and voters of color an equal opportunity to fully participate in the electoral process.
Can you tell me a little bit more about those bills, like what's in them?
Yeah. Definitely. And, you can also go to the California Democracy Partnership website and you can read the fact sheets about both of these bills. But, they basically enshrine into California law some of the historic Voting Rights Act protections that, we just saw dismantled at the federal law with the recent Calais Supreme Court decision. So they prohibit voter suppression. They prohibit vote dilution, which would protect against district maps or election systems that weaken or silence the voting power of communities of color and, preserve that opportunity for communities of interest to elect representatives that reflect their interests. It would require jurisdictions with a recent history of discrimination to obtain approval before making certain changes to voting practices. Again, a lot of this is mirroring what we've had for a long time in Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court just gutted. It would ensure that voters can directly protect their rights and require courts to interpret laws in favor of voters. So that is all in SB 1164. And then the sister bill, SB 1360, is really about expanding language access as well and making sure that all voters are able to participate in our democracy in a language that they understand.
So what steps can voters take to make sure that their votes are counted given these threats and these changes that we're seeing?
So obviously, we want to encourage everyone to vote in the California primary election that will take place on Tuesday, June 2nd. You can still register to vote through May 18th at registertovote.ca.gov. You can also, if you think you're registered but you're not entirely sure, or you think maybe your signature has changed over time and you want to re-register to update that signature, you can do all that at voterstatus.sos.ca.gov. And you can also choose a language other than English to receive all your voting materials in at that website. And then, obviously, the last day to actually vote is June 2nd, Election Day. The voting locations are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. And one of the things that, we've worked really hard to do in California is make sure that voters can vote in a variety of ways and make sure that, we're providing lots of different ways so people can work voting into their schedules and their normal lives. So you can vote by mail. You just have to make, mark your ballot and seal it inside the envelope provided and then sign and date the envelope. And we're really encouraging folks right now, given, what you accurately just said about the mail and the postal service, make sure to mail back your ballot early. We recommend getting it in the mail at least 5 days before Election Day on June 2nd. You can also drop off your ballot if you want to hand it in instead of mailing it in. You just have to find one of those drop boxes in your community and make sure you drop it in there no later than 8 p.m. on Election Day. You can see where those secure ballot drop boxes are in your county by going to caearlyvoting.sos.ca.gov. And then finally, you can vote in person at your local polling location. You can find those locations at findmypollingplace.sos.ca.gov. And then after you've returned your ballot, whether through mail or through drop-off or through voting in person, you can actually check the status of your ballot at wheresmyballot.sos.ca.gov to find out where your ballot is in the process and when it has been accepted.
Sure. You also mentioned early voting. Do you know, I know there are early voting drop boxes. Do you know if there's in-person early voting?
Yes. Several counties have opened up early voting in-person polling locations, and you can find where those locations are at caearlyvoting.sos.ca.gov.
You mentioned same-day voting, so people can register to vote and vote on the same day. How does that process work?
In California, we just want to make sure that everyone has a chance to vote. So to vote in California, you just have to be a U.S. citizen and a resident of California. You have to be 18 years or older on election day, not currently serving a state or federal prison term for conviction of a felony, and not currently found mentally incompetent. As long as you meet those four requirements, you, even if you're not yet registered, you can still show up at your local polling place and register right then and there and cast a ballot on election day. We encourage people, of course, though, if they're listening to this ahead of election day, to go ahead and register just to make the process as easy as possible.
All right. Jenny Farrell, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks so much for having us.
And that was Jenny Farrell, Executive Director of the League of Women Voters of California.
The future is on the line. Democracy hangs in the balance. The stakes couldn't be higher.